Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to CSIS, and welcome to a program which is a joint production of the program on international policy attitudes, PIPA, represented here by Steve Cull and Steve Weber, and two different programs within CSIS. I'm Teresita Schaefer, I'm director of the South Asia program. And on my left is Seema Patel, who is with the program on post-conflict resolution, whose co-director is sitting in the front row, Rick Barton, trying to make sure we don't say anything wrong. What we have on the agenda this afternoon is a topic of enormous interest and importance for audiences in Washington, and that is Afghanistan. What are things like? What are people thinking? Steve Weber is going to present on behalf of PIPA the results of some polling that they carried out in Afghanistan in the past month or so. I also have Seema Patel, who will comment on it from the perspective of a large number of in-depth interviews that she carried out in Afghanistan. What was it, in July, September?
In August.
August. Well, I've got both sides of it there. It will be quite understandable if you find the mix confusing, because in many respects they came up with either different findings or different emphases. I think that tells you something about the difficulty of being sure of what you were dealing with in Afghanistan. What both of these surveys do underline is some of the challenges of addressing security and governance over the long term, and that precisely is where the important challenge lies for U.S. policy and for U.S. national security. So, without further ado, let me turn the proceedings over to Stephen J. Weber, who is going to talk about the polling, which is the most recent addition to our effort to understand what's going on in Afghanistan.
Thank you. A thumbnail background of some of the events in Afghanistan, but looking at this audience, I think that wouldn't be necessary. I might just suggest that you go and visit the CSIS website, where you can hear some read some very recent stuff and hear some things from people like Anthony Cordesman, Seema Patel, earlier a paper by Tessie. And that's an excellent place to get up to speed on the issues if by chance some of you want some further background. I guess I wanted to start with just broadly the fact that there's a debate about how the international community should help Afghanistan. Should military assistance have primacy in trying to solve the problems of Afghanistan, or should economic aid be a priority? The Afghan people's reservoir of goodwill may evaporate if they do not see more improvement in their lives. This survey puts these issues to Afghans themselves. Do Afghans see progress being made, or do they believe their country is headed toward another crisis? How do they feel about their government and about the foreign military forces that fight on its behalf? Do they believe more military help is the key, or would they prefer greater emphasis on aid designed to help them rebuild their country? I think there's a few things that we should consider as we look at survey data from a country such as Afghanistan, which is very different than the country that we live most of our time these days. Something we have to recognize, whether you're doing in-depth interviews as Seema does or the more quantitative studies that this particular project represents, is that every interview is a social interaction between two people, the interviewer and the respondent. People from some countries tend to be more courteous during this interview. They may often offer an answer which they think is expected or nice. When we participate in an interview, we often do that as well. Some of this tendency to be nice seems evident when you poll Afghans. Also, Afghanistan has a very different and difficult history over the past two decades. Their assessments of their government leaders will have an implied comparison probably, to what occurred during the 1980s and 1990s. So I would suggest as we look at this data, we look for the following patterns. Changes in opinions over time. We've got two waves of the survey that we're presenting today. One that was done the last week of November, the first week of December 2005, and the other, which was done, completed about 3 weeks ago in 2006. I'd also suggest that we look at differences in how Afghans view different programs or possibilities, and how Afghans make a choice when they're asked to choose between two potentially desirable options. So World Public Opinion and the Program on International Policy Attitudes, we've been conducting polls in Afghanistan and Iraq over the past year, and a variety of other countries too. Today's study of the Afghan public was conducted November 13th to November 24th. It's a national random sample based upon a probability sample of 32 of Afghan's 34 provinces. Two provinces, Zabul and Uruzgan, were omitted for security reasons. The interviewing was face-to-face interviews conducted by D3 Systems and its partner, the Afghan Center for Social and Opinion Research, which is headquartered in Kabul. Interviewers were Afghan nationals, and there was a gender matching of respondents and interviewers. The sample size just completed was 2,097, a similar sample in 2005. And the sampling error with a sample of this size and this design is about 3.5 percentage points. We, in some of our analyses, break down different sections of Afghanistan that are comprised of provinces. The two white spaces are the two provinces that where no interviews were conducted. What you will hear me mention mostly in this presentation is the southwest, the south central, and areas that border on Pakistan, the mountainous regions of Pakistan. The southwest, to be specific, comprises the Kandahar province and the Helmand province, those two provinces. There's a classic question that pollsters often ask. Do you think things in your country are going in the right direction, or you think they're going in the wrong direction? We asked this in 2005 and 2006. What we find is that most people in Afghanistan think they're going in the right direction. In 2006, as of 3 weeks ago, 62% thought things in Afghanistan were going in the right direction. 35% thought they were going in the wrong direction. But if you compare this to 2005, this is down 21 percentage points. That we see a clear worsening of their assessment of how their country is going, even though most say it's heading in the right direction. So back in 2005, we had about 8 people say right direction for every one who said wrong direction. In 2006, it's less than 2-1. I wanted to put this in context because ABC and BBC recently conducted a poll where they used a very similar question, and they found generally similar responses. They found that in October 2005, 77% said Afghanistan's heading in the right direction. In 2006, they found that 55% said Afghanistan is heading in the right direction. They also had another category of mixed, which captured some votes as well. This is a question that's asked classically around the world, and you could have tracked our president's standing and the Republican Party's standing over the last 12 months by looking at Gallup or other poll sources that ask the same question. One other point of reference I would like to put out is we asked this question in Iraq twice in 2006. What we found was in January 2006, 64% of Iraqis said their country was heading in the right direction. By September 2006, that had dropped to 47%, and in effect, a majority said it was heading in the wrong direction by September. Another interesting insight into what this question can reveal is looking at the different sectarian groups in Iraq. What we found, if you look at the Shia on top, we found that the Shia 84% said it was heading in the right direction in January, but only 59%, a substantial drop by September. The Kurds, a smaller drop. The Sunni never thought their country was heading in the right direction. All right, that 6% said we're heading in the right direction in January. 6% said we're heading in the right direction in October and September. So this, what I wanted to use these other examples for is to both show that it is possible, even in conflict areas like Afghanistan and Iraq, you can do consistent quantitative surveys that are reliable. And secondly, that if you can look and look at the data in the proper ways, I think you can get some insights into what's happening in a particular country. We ask a series of questions about the president, the government, and other major players in Afghanistan. We asked, for each of the following, please tell me if your opinion is very favorable, somewhat favorable, etc. In terms of President Karzai, we found that President Karzai gets very favorable ratings, 90% roughly, giving me either a somewhat favorable rating or a very favorable rating. This is quite high. It's not unheard of. Vladimir Putin gets scores about like this, all right? But he has very high ratings. But if you look closely, the number of people who said very favorable has dropped from 68% to 55% over the last year. What about the effectiveness of the central government? We asked an effectiveness battery as well. People generally endorse their central government and say it's very effective or somewhat effective. There's a slight diminishment of people who say their central government is very effective. What about local leaders? The central government gets higher ratings here and elsewhere in our study than the local leaders do. But the local leaders are showing a bit of improvement. It may be that as pressures increase on Afghanistan and violence increases, people may look a bit more to their local leaders and have more confidence in their local leaders than they do in their central government. What about the ISAF? People also say the ISAF is very effective or somewhat effective. Also, this is down from a year ago. What about U.S. forces in Afghanistan? If you ask a question like this in Iraq, you find out that people in Iraq have no confidence in U.S. military and feel that the U.S. military forces are a cause of disorder rather than prevent disorder. In Afghanistan, what you find is that the public is rather favorable towards U.S. forces, but less favorable than they were a year ago. Opinion of the U.S., they like the U.S. as well, both last year and currently, but this is down too. And so what we have here is a battery of items of favorability and effectiveness items that the public tends to give their government, their president, the international forces good scores on. We may be seeing the Afghans being nice to us and to these players in some of these questions. At the same time, they're becoming less nice very consistently. All right? As we look at some other issues in the study, the texture changes, the dynamism changes a little bit. We asked Afghans, thinking about the reconstructions of roads, schools, and hospitals, and water supplies, would you say the progress has been excellent or good, fair or poor? Here, a majority say progress in reconstruction has been fair or poor, 58%. We asked, here's an effectiveness of aid groups who administer these programs. The aid groups get very positive ratings because, in fact, people may be saying, we appreciate that these people are here and what they're doing. Okay? When we look at exactly what's happening in my area in terms of the roads and in terms of the water, I'm less satisfied. We also asked, have you or someone in your family been personally affected by an act of corruption by government officials in the past 12 months? You or someone in your family personally been affected? This is not a story that you've heard, you or someone in your family. 24% of Afghans said, yes, me or one of my family members has been affected by an act of government corruption. Now, if you look at corruption and through this yes, no, look at ratings of President Karzai, you find that people say, yes, we've experienced corruption. They rate President Karzai lower. They say they're less likely to say our country is heading in the right direction if they've experienced corruption. Similarly, when people were dissatisfied with the progress of reconstruction, those who were dissatisfied gave the central government lower ratings and also said that we're less likely to say their government was heading in the right direction. So it seems like corruption and lack of progress in reconstruction are some of the underpinnings of these negative trends that we see. We ask the public in Afghanistan, do you think you need more military aid or economic aid? Choose one. And in a sense, we were asking them to be policy wonks, but we really weren't. We tried to present a simple case to them. You know, given your experience, do you think your country needs more military aid or more economic assistance? 50% when they were supposed to choose one or the other said more economic aid, and only 13% said more military aid. However, it's important to note, despite the binary choice we gave them, 34% said they wanted more of both. Okay? So I think the picture we draw from this is, on balance, economic aid is seen by many as a greater need, because when they have to make that forced choice, it's about 4-1. But they don't accept, many people, a third of the people don't accept that forced choice. When we look at it in a regional analysis, it's not so surprising. In the southwest, Kandahar and Helmand, where there's been more Taliban activity, or a lot of Taliban activity, in fact, they tend to want slightly more military aid when they have a binary choice, or they want more of both. So if you combine both military aid and both types of aid, 66% of the people in the southwest want military aid as part of the package. All right. What are people's opinion about the Taliban? This is a question we asked in 2005. We asked it again in 2006 to see, you know, is the Taliban making headway in terms of people's feelings about them? The answer is no. If you do a representative sample of Afghans, they tell us that 92% have very unfavorable or somewhat unfavorable views of the Taliban. In fact, the number of people who say very unfavorable increased in the last year from 62% to 71%. Okay, so in terms of the Taliban winning the hearts of the public in Afghanistan, there's no evidence here. We have some additional questions, though. What about regionally? What do we see? Well, we see in the East region, in the South Central region, and the Southwest region, all bordering on Pakistan, that favorability is a bit higher. Okay. Now, these are traditional areas of strength for the Taliban. Kandahar in the Southwest was a long-time stronghold. And so this may be just a persistent positive feelings about the Taliban. And in fact, in these three areas, while they're the highest of the seven regions, they didn't increase in favorability from 2005 to 2006. What about Osama bin Laden? Well, Osama bin Laden is not a popular figure as well. We've asked similar questions in Iraq, and he's not a popular figure there either. Overall, do you think that overthrowing the Taliban was a good thing or bad thing for Afghanistan? The great majority of people say overthrowing the Taliban was a good thing. It even went up a little bit. That's statistically significant. It's not very large. But clearly, the Taliban doesn't seem to be reversing their standing in the eyes of the Afghan people. What about looking at regional differences? Here's where we have an interesting finding. Overall, 86% say it's a good thing that the Taliban was overthrown. In the Southwest, 43% of the public in the Southwest, we had about 200 respondents in the Southwest, said it was a bad thing. And in fact, in the Southwest, the number of people saying it was a bad thing went from 13% to 43%. And so I think our read on this is that the Southwest, the Taliban's presence is being felt in the Southwest. There might be more violence in the Southwest. And while people don't necessarily like the Taliban, they may be becoming less sure that this whole transformation and throwing out the Taliban was necessarily a good thing. We're trying to grapple also with who people see to be the important authorities in their area. Is it the central government? Are they really the top dog and the important authority, the most powerful authority? Is it the local leaders? Is it the Taliban? We had a hypothesis that people might say, I don't like the Taliban, but they run this place around here, okay? 76% of the people say, when we ask them which is the most powerful authority, that it's the central government. 20% say local leaders, 2% say Taliban. Now, yeah. We broke out the regional data, and once again, the Southwest, 10% of the people in the Southwest say the Taliban is the most powerful authority in the Southwest. That's the highest region. It's still only a small minority of the people, though. We said, well, maybe the Taliban might not be the most powerful, but they might be respected, or the local leaders might be respected because the central government is not. What we find is still the central government is seen as the most respected authority in this region. Local leaders score somewhat higher in respect than power, and the Taliban budges practically not at all. Once again, the Southwest stands apart a bit from the rest of the country. We were trying to get a gauge of whether people saw the Taliban gaining ground. And so do you feel that in the conflict between the central government, including NATO forces, and the Taliban, do you think the Taliban has gained ground, lost ground, or that there's been no real change? 33% said gained ground, 37% said lost ground, 28% said no real change. And whether 33% is a lot or a little, I'm not sure. We didn't ask this question last year, but in some ways I think it signifies that there's a substantial portion of people in Afghanistan who see movement on the side of the Taliban. How likely is it, do you think, the Taliban will return and take over governing Afghanistan? 16% said it's very or somewhat likely in their view. 82% said it's not at all likely or not very likely. 48% said they felt, almost half across the country, said they felt that it's not at all likely that the Taliban is going to return to power. If we look at this regionally, we find out that the Southwest and the West have somewhat higher expectations for the Taliban, in that 25% of the people in Southwest say they think it's at least somewhat likely, and 31% of the people in the West think it's at least somewhat likely that the Taliban may return. One of the questions that we asked two questions on security. How would you rate the security situation in your area? Would you say that it's excellent, good, fair, poor? And this question produced somewhat puzzling findings for us. People said security was better in 06 than 05. We asked another question. Compared to about a year ago, do you think the security situation in your area has gotten better? People tend to say it's gotten better. And we have a number of hypotheses about what contributes to this. if you look at regions, you find out that areas of conflict get lower security ratings. And so areas with relatively less conflict, the North and the West, get very high security ratings. And so there may be some regional differences. We speculated about a differing role of ISAF forces. There are other ways that we might explain this as well, but this was, in some respects, the most puzzling piece of data that we came across. What about Pakistan's influence in the world? Do you see Pakistan to have a positive influence in the world or a negative influence in the world? Afghans see it has a negative, see it as having a negative influence in the world, and this image is getting worse, from 63% in 2005 to 75%, judging Pakistan having a negative role. Do you think the Pakistan government is allowing the Taliban to operate in Pakistan, or do you think it is seriously trying to stop the Taliban from operating in Pakistan? 79% think that the Pakistani government is allowing the Taliban to operate in Pakistan. This is increasing. Maybe they're reading the CSIS website. Maybe they're listening to their president. Maybe they just know what's going on in their country. But this is the view of the public in Afghanistan. A final issue that we approach, I think it's the final issue, is whether people approve or disapprove of international military forces' efforts to stop the growing of opium poppies in Afghanistan. There's been, in my light reading of the literature, there's a great deal of discussion of this issue. What we find is that most Afghans approve of efforts to stop the growing of opium poppies, but this is declining. So from 78% to 67%, now 32% disapprove of these international military forces' efforts. What if you look at this regionally? You find that in the East, the Southwest, and the West, fully 50% of the public in those areas disapprove of international military forces' efforts to stop growing opium poppies. I'd like to just make a couple summary points. If we look at this contest between in Afghanistan, it's substantially a political one, and frankly, that's the turf that we at PEPA are more comfortable on. And if we understand political in the broadest sense, these are the findings that we tend to see. The Taliban is certainly not winning the battle for the minds and hearts of the Afghan people. The Taliban is viewed very negatively. They are generally not seen as powers in any of the broader regions we examined. We can't tell what's happening in micro areas, in villages, small portions of Kandahar. But across regions, across the country, they're not seen as to being the force. The central government and President Karzai still seem to have a reservoir of goodwill and respect, but there are danger signs. NATO troops and international agencies seem well regarded by the majority of the populace, but their stock is slipping as well. The majority of Afghans see the progress of reconstruction as fair or poor, and dissatisfaction with reconstruction is related to feelings that the country is not going in the right direction. When asked to choose between economic help and more military help, Afghans tend to choose economic help, but one-third choose both. And programs to suppress growing poppies still have majority support, but is diminishing, and it's no longer majority support in some very consequential regions. Okay, that's the extent of our survey presentation today. I want to say, as you leave, you can pick up a copy of our full report and the questionnaire with all the data, and I'd like to turn it back to Tessie now.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I have asked Seema Patel to give you the flavor of the interviews that she conducted in Afghanistan. And then I've got a few thoughts that I'd like to share, and I think Steve Kull does as well. And then we will open it up for questions. So, Seema, why don't you kick off?
Hello, thank you for allowing me to comment on the poll that just came through. I think I'll start by outlining some of the challenges we face in assessing progress in countries as complicated and in such a critical moment as Afghanistan, and then move into comparing our findings from the interviews that we conducted in the field with the polling survey, the polls findings. Essentially, a few months ago, I noticed that the NATO commander, General Richards, had claimed that if the Afghan government and its international partners don't put more attention into improving Afghans' lives, we're going to lose the support in the of the people. And he put a six-month timeline on that. Around the same time, Rumsfeld came out with an op-ed where he basically outlined a shopping list of positive indicators, concluding that we are at a hopeful and promising time in Afghanistan. So the question comes to our mind at CSIS, and one of the things we try to do is find ways to basically help the public and the policymakers assess what progress is looking like on the ground. Given these divergent viewpoints, it becomes difficult, starts to sound like political spin, and so we tried to create an evidence-based way of doing it. Measuring progress, no matter what method is used, we see as being essential to making progress. Knowing where we are in the mission, whether we are at the tipping point, at a point where Afghans can start to take over critical needs, is essential to knowing what our exit strategies are and knowing how we can attune our strategies to make better progress on the ground. We know that an exercise in measuring progress has to be more than collecting statistics, quantitative statistics on number of roads built and number of kids in school, number of hospital beds available in regional hospitals, but has to get at what we see as more critical. Basically, how are Afghans viewing the changes in their lives? Polling is one method that does this. It allows basically policymakers sitting in Kabul or sitting in Washington, D.C. and Brussels, far away from the local villages, to get a sense of where Afghans' perceptions are and what their experiences are. PIPA's World Opinion Poll, as well as Asia Foundation, came out with a larger study in 2006. And one that many people don't know about, but that is available, that's not classified, is CFC Alpha's Afghanistan National Development Poll, which is very extensive as well, but quite difficult to find, as I spent weeks trying to find it when I was on the ground there. What they do is basically allow Afghans to have a voice in the policymaking at a time when they feel that they're not being heard by their government and by the international partners. We attempted to go beyond, above and beyond. It's our attempt to integrate a number of great methods to capture progress into one holistic study. Essentially, what we do is, it's called the Measure of Progress. We did a baseline study in 2006. And what we do is we collect information from a wide group of sources, including media, public documentation that's put out by governments and by NGOs. We conduct in-depth Afghan interviews. And we also include polls and surveys that are done by organizations like PIPA into our data sets. What we are trying to do is balance biases, allow everybody's voice to be put into one hat, shake it up, and see what we get out of it. And, some of the interesting things that come out of this kind of a methodology is to compare the different methodologies against each other. What we found in 2005 was that Afghan interviews, talking to Afghans, they seem to be the most positive of all the other different sources. This year, what we're finding is that the survey data is actually the most positive methodology that's out there in terms of how lives are improving, and by quite a bit. And I think that that's where we should start to get into some of the conversation about different findings coming out of different methodologies. With the support of USAID, I conducted 1,000 interviews over the summer, as Tezi mentioned. And what we did is we trained the group of Afghan interviewers, instead of providing them with a set of questions that were predetermined, what we did is we taught our interviewers to engage them in structured conversations, allowing the interviewee to determine what are their priority areas in their lives, their experiences, and also providing explanations of why they're experiencing those in their own words and terminology. In this way, we hope to get around one of the problems that comes in polling data, which is how to interpret critical words. For example, some of the words that pop out at me when I see polls are things like security. What does security mean to Afghans? Is it something different to women? Is effective the same as legitimate or fair and trustworthy? And who are the local leaders in Afghanistan? I mean, people who know the country knows that can be a very charged word in terms of what that means. Is it the provincial governor or the new provincial councils that have been elected? Or is it traditional leaders like imams and village elders, tribal elders? Is it whoever's holding the gun? And can Afghans tell? One of the things that came out of our interviews is that in certain areas in Afghanistan, particularly in the south and east, they're having a hard time figuring out who's in charge and where, you know, who the people are that they're seeing in charge, what their background is. So, you know, I realize that measuring progress in a context like Afghanistan is difficult and an enormous task for the international community, but critical to us making good strategic decisions. It's been a welcome and a personal challenge to me to be able to interpret the interviews, reading over them, and try to pull out trends from them. But we were able to pull out some really interesting trends in the 2006 study, from the 2005 to the 2006 study. And there's some differences that we'd like to highlight, but there are also some similarities. Our broad conclusions are pretty much in line with the World Opinion poll. Afghan optimism is declining. Majority of people are expressing frustration with the slow pace of reconstruction efforts. Progress in social services and basic infrastructure, which has been the focus of a lot of international development programming, has not met Afghan expectations. And the Taliban, although far from declaring, you know, the Taliban are far from declaring victory on the competition for Afghan hearts and minds, but they don't have to. I mean, they can create enough instability for the government and NATO to lose ground, which is what we're also seeing in the country. Where we differ is that our findings show a much bleaker outlook. It's clear that we, in our findings, that we are falling into a dangerous zone where Afghan needs are not being met, and people are losing, you know, the confidence that the government will have the capacity or indeed has the will to meet their needs You know, some of the critical services that, you know, you asked what do Afghans want to see more is economic or military aid. And this is, I think, gets at the heart of something very important in terms of doing these kind of interviews down there, is what are Afghan priorities? You know, the ones we come up with as being most critical are things like electricity, jobs, income opportunities, and establishing a rule of law. And those are areas where we haven't made a lot of progress, the ones that they find most important in their lives. So, you know, another nuance that we were able to get to, which is Afghans' confidence in Karzai and the central government. The poll comes up with fairly very high views of Karzai and fairly high views of the central government. Last year, in 2005, we saw that Karzai's ratings were through the roof. You know, people had confidence that in him as a fair and honest broker. And there was actually kind of a disconnect between their feelings of Karzai and their feelings of the central government, in the sense that because Karzai was fair and honest, the central government was going to be able to, you know, become effective at meeting their needs in the future. Now, with we see confidence in Karzai really diminishing, and the reasons that we see behind that is essentially the level of corruption and the presence of criminalized actors in the government that have not been taken out of the loop. And a lot of people are pointing their finger on the ground at Karzai for not taking a stronger step against the people that they see as being illegitimate. For the Taliban, onto the Taliban. You know, the Taliban has managed to gain ground in the south and east. And although most Afghans are not in areas where they are the most powerful authority, the sense of insecurity is spreading across the country. In essence, when you have hubs like city centers and critical roads being too insecure to travel on, and when you have targeted killings scaring experienced people into joining the corps of the police officers or the corps of teachers or government officials because they're fearing for their lives, what you end up happening is that not only security is undermined to some extent, but so is good governance, trade, education, And the Taliban does not need to be in power to have that happen. And that's the sort of trend that we see coming out of our Afghan interviews. Also, you know, I wanted to get into talk about Poppy and security, but I think that maybe we'll leave that for the question and answer time, because I think that those are critical issues where we can get into more nuance and you know, bounce off of each other in terms of trying to figure out what these polls are saying and what they mean. Some of the other nuances that we can offer from our findings is that we categorized our data also by region, but we went into urban and rural divides, gender divides, ethnic groupings, so that we could basically assess what are the differences and the nuances that Afghans are experiencing in different places and according to where where their lives are. One of my favorite findings of our report is that the north and the west in the cities, the places where we have made the most progress, are still more supportive of the central government and are still better off in terms of security and economic and social well-being, but they have experienced a more pronounced deterioration in their livelihoods than have the people in the south and the east, which was already at a pretty dismal point. So, you know, the interpretation of this is that the international community and its Afghan government might be losing the people that they had gained, losing the support of the people that they had gained over the past 4 years. Another interesting point is the lives of women. The lives of women has improved significantly, while men interpret deterioration. Women point to economic and social improvements as the most positive areas, and men point to security. So, another interesting topic to go through. Essentially, you know, I come away with my trip in Afghanistan and continuing to read and look at all the interviews that we've got with a real sense of urgency. The deterioration, the degradation in a number of sectors, in a number of provinces is really shocking. What is most important, I think, is how Afghans feel about the improvement in their lives. You know, that to me is the essence of whether we are going to win the fight in the long term, is if they see measurable, visible, you know, improvement that makes it easier for them to improve that empowers them to engage. And I think that that might be more critical than whether institutions are being built in Kabul that, you know, in the future might be able to trickle down and affect the ordinary person. And I think on that front, we're really losing ground. New resources are needed, and I think that the international community members that I talked to on the ground were quite, you know, adamant that they needed new resources. I think they were feeling the squeeze that they weren't able to do the programming that they wanted to do because they weren't getting the attention out here in Washington, D.C. that they needed to. And I think that the challenges that we're going to face in 2007 with a resurgence of violence and instability and insecurity in the South is really going to spill over. And if we don't figure out ways to try and get the money to the ground to improve those lives today and turn these negative trends around, I think by the next year we're going to face a much tighter mission.
So. Thank you, Seema. I'm going to ask Steve to go next, and I will wind up and then bring us to the question period.
I have a few comments. This question, first of all, why, you know, you look at these numbers and they look so rosy in terms of a number of variables, and it's really there are a few important things to notice. One is that they don't think that the Taliban is about to gain power. That's really important. So when you ask about security, that's, well, against what? And they don't see it as an immediate threat. It's also important to remember that when you talk about security or anything like this, the people are referencing a baseline of expectations. And what constitutes security for somebody, for people like you and me, may be quite different from somebody in Afghanistan feels. 58% say that they see that things are better now than they were under the Taliban, and if you go back further, it probably could be worse. These people have had a very miserable life, and so they may feel that things are still are not that bad relative to their expectations, and in a sense are better. And it's not that they're not reporting any kind of problems. 40% say that they often or sometimes fear for their own personal security or the safety of their family. 13% in the last year say that a family member had been a victim of physical aggression or some criminal act in their home or their community. Now, if those applied to us, we'd say we are in terrible shape. That may not be so for them. Now, but now let's look at it more in terms of what it implies in terms of policy. We are seeing slippage. We are seeing frustration. Now, you look at these numbers, and in absolute terms, there's support of the government, there's support of NATO forces, the Taliban's unpopular, and again, if these kinds of numbers were to be what our president found, he'd say, I'm in great shape. But in the U.S., you have the attitudes are much more deep-rooted. Party ID is something that you mostly get from your parents, and it stays there. In Afghanistan, my understanding is Afghans are famous for being incredibly fluid in terms of their loyalty, that they like a winner. There's not an ideological route that attaches the people to any particular group. And it's unlikely, you know, when you look at these, you go, gee, could it be really that good? It's unlikely that they're holding in internal views that are to the contrary. It's more of concern that these attachments are relatively flimsy, that they're not deep-rooted, and that they could shift. These people, again, they're survivors, and if they perceive that the forces are moving in a way that's against them, or that makes where they are inconvenient, they could well move. And it's really key that in areas where the Taliban is operating, you might think, well, then there's insecurity there. They probably are feeling annoyed about the Taliban. No, actually, in those areas, they feel better about the Taliban. So what's going on there? My assumption is that there's a kind of subtle realignment going on as they perceive the Taliban gaining strength. So it's tempting to read these numbers as reassuring, but I don't think you should necessarily assume that. And I think when we look at the attitudes about economic development, that's really key. There's dissatisfaction about economic development, and when we looked at the perceptions of of economic development, their views of it, and correlated that with attitudes about the government, attitudes about NATO forces, attitudes about the Taliban, they were highly correlated. If you don't think things are going so well in terms of economic development, you're less likely to approve of the government, you're more likely to have a positive view of the Taliban, you're less likely to approve of NATO forces, and so on. So all these things I see this kind of precariousness, and a key factor is economic development. And if frustration about economic development grew, that could weaken some of these alignments. If the Taliban continues to be perceived as gaining strength, that could subtly modify these alignments, and then they could shift fairly strongly in the future.
Just to wind up, I would like to focus on a handful of issues which it has become, I think, quite commonplace in Washington to look on as the critical ones that are going to determine where Afghanistan is going. And you will see most of them spelled out in the CSIS South Asia Monitor that I think was waiting for you outside the room. The first of these is narcotics. The estimates that one hears is that the overall narcotics trade accounts for anywhere from 40% to 75% of Afghan GDP. I wouldn't want to put my hand in the fire to defend any one of those figures, but in any case, it's a large number. The poll had interesting and quite negative attitudes towards efforts to stamp out the narcotics trade. The thing that makes it so difficult to deal with the narcotics problem is that it has become the center of a whole set of social relationships. The farmer by all accounts, gets a relatively small percentage of the take. The trade is driven much more by the distributors and by the wholesalers who go up the food chain from there. When I was in Afghanistan in June and spoke to NATO officials who were not officially charged with narcotics, because that's not part of their brief, but whose job included worrying about it, they drew a sharp distinction between eradication efforts on the one hand and efforts to find alternative livelihoods, which now has an acronym, AL, on the other. AL was regarded by the people on the ground, alternative livelihoods, as absolutely essential. In the absence of that, even some of the international officials dealing with narcotics had deep reservations about eradication efforts. And I can't help wondering if some of that ambiguity didn't account for the very interesting findings you had there. The second issue, which is on everyone's worry list, is policing or lack thereof. And particularly the observation that the police are predominantly the creatures of the provincial government and have become centers of patronage more than of professional policing. There wasn't anything that directly related to this, but there's lots of anecdotal evidence that suggests that this is, in fact, a disaster area. And it's difficult to imagine establishing an orderly governmental framework until that begins to work a bit better than it's been doing now. Third issue is governance, which is indirectly covered in your survey by the attitudes towards the central government, local governments, and Karzai, and which certainly figured in your interviews as well. And corruption. The significance of the corruption issue, I think, is very important, that people seem to be looking on that as an index of whether the government is doing its job. That is a real warning bell that's ringing and ringing loudly. The government has to do more things than just not shake people down, but not shaking people down would certainly be a nice starting point. But part of what the government also has to do is to develop mechanisms for resolving disputes. The justice system, dealing with criminal activity. And that is another thing which, by all accounts, has been a very slow participant in the reconstruction process, and some would say is not working at all. So with all the sage comments about how to interpret polls, I come away from both of these presentations reinforced in my view that these three topics are very important, that our ability to measure how well we're doing is imperfect, but the tools we have suggest that there's a lot of work yet to be done. And with that, let me open the floor up to questions and answers. There's a gentleman in the back of the room.
Hi, thanks. Tom Robichaud with Afghanistan Watch. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your findings with regard to both police and courts. Were there any survey questions on that? And Seema, what were some of the responses that came up in your interviews?
I can answer that pointedly and briefly. We didn't have any questions on either policing or courts. Our question on corruption, was your family touched by government corruption, probably bears on that, but it doesn't explicitly bear on that. Mm-hmm. I would suggest, though, that I think it's the Asia Foundation survey that you can find on their website that explores policing in courts, I believe, in more detail.
Seema?
Some of the interviews that I did that focused on policing, and also in our Afghan interviews, the general trend is that people's views of the police are quite negative, much more negative, so much more so than the army, the views of the army. There's a number of reasons that we point to that. I mean, for that essentially is that there's very little oversight over the police, and they're not out there with mentors the way the ANA is out there with international mentors, and so they're sort of left on their own device in the district areas. Like Tezi mentioned, some of them are coming under local leadership and serving as almost bodyguards and personnel for powerful people, be they government officials or not. And I think most Afghans, the way they view it is they don't see the police maintaining law and order, but kind of going about their, you know, trying to sort of squeeze out some bribery and control some roads. And one of the interesting things that I heard people say about the police is that they were un-Islamic. And I think that that's actually probably more of a critical, you know, negative viewpoint than them being ineffective or being bodyguards, but that they're actually contrary to sort of traditional views of how to behave. Courts also, I mean, they work together, but they don't, is part of the things that I saw down there. Police let go of people before the courts can prosecute them, and the courts, you know, don't have the capability to do investigations. And so they don't work very seamlessly together. As for the ordinary Afghans, courts tend to be very corrupt, and formal courts are corrupt. They can't afford to go to them because they have to pay out briberies. So it's not only that they're illegitimate, they just simply can't afford it. And so they end up going back towards the informal systems, which tend to adjudicate quite well and quite legitimately, especially in the rural areas where they're out there in sort of big numbers.
I have Stan Kober first.
Stan Kober with the Cato Institute. People also vote with their feet. After the Taliban were overthrown, a lot of expat Afghans went back. To my understanding, that is now reversing, and they're leaving Afghanistan on that basis. And also Afghans themselves, there's now an increasing immigration. Do any of the panelists have some information on that?
Do you have any information on this?
I don't have flows or numbers, and I couldn't give you any good nice numbers for you, but one of the things that when I was talking to a lot of expats, and I just have some interviews with expats, is that a lot of them are working in, went home to set up businesses. And the small businesses or mid-sized businesses back in Afghanistan, and what they're seeing is that it's more difficult to run a business when there's insecurity, both in Kabul and outside. And so they were having trouble getting supplies across, you know, around the country, and they don't really have quite the connections that a lot of local Afghans do to keep business running when they're from the diaspora community. And so some of them are picking up and turning back because it is quite an investment that they stand to lose. That's
yes, sir.
I'm from the region.
Could you give your name and your affiliation, please?
My name is Vijay Kumar. Mm-hmm. I'm from India. The question I had was that security being a secondary issue, and recent newspapers have reported a lot of Taliban activity, Peshawar, Quetta. So do you think there should be a policy change within the U.S. government to take a much more stronger view against Pakistan?
The whole question of the Pakistan government's attitude towards the Taliban and how far up it goes is certainly an extremely difficult one. I can think of no more complicated issue for the U.S. government to deal with. And looking at it from Pakistan's point of view, that surely is the problem with the greatest risk of exploding their relationship with the United States, which is something very important to President Musharraf. I have every reason to think that this is on the agenda between the United States and Pakistan. It certainly belongs there. From Pakistan's perspective, the best outcome would be for Karzai's government to take hold, stabilize, reduce the chaos on that difficult frontier, and establish a decent relationship with Pakistan. The trouble is, I don't think either Karzai or Musharraf has much confidence that the relationship is going to improve. If you saw the TV clips at the time President Bush invited them both to dinner, both of the guests looked as if they wished they were on a different planet. And from Pakistan's point of view, I don't think they have much confidence that Karzai is going to pull it off. And so I think that certainly for many people in the army, the second best solution is a client. And that leads you into a lot of, I would say, very destructive ways of dealing with the situation.
Is that ISI helping
after
the rescue?
ISI at one level is an order-taking organization. It is part of the army. On the other hand, like every other intelligence agency in the world, it doesn't like to give up an asset. which the Taliban certainly used to be. And I think they're fairly good at not telling the boss things that they think the boss may not wish to know. So I'm not sure how effectively the U.S. will be able to get at that problem. I think the problem's going to be with us for a while.
Can I ask the Stevens, in your polling, when you start to see a downward trend, have you done polling just before a situation went to hell, and you can see that the public does, you don't just have a downward trend, but you have a plane crash. Do you have any experience that you can relate to in another place where you've seen that phenomenon? Because I assume, in some ways, the public may be the last to know when it's not unlike being an airplane passenger. And so I just wonder whether you've got evidence of that, because it's a theory that we're working with. And actually, we use the plane crash as one of our examples, that plane crash in the Everglades a couple of years ago, if you ever read that dissection of that accident. It was a particularly good example of how a lot of things start to go wrong, and then it's a disaster as opposed to just
It's the whole tipping point model.
Yeah. So I wonder how that shows up. Is there something reassuring about numbers? And of course, in our country, the number never gets below 28%.
Well, it's fairly new that there is polling being done in unstable situations. It's market research has just been so persistent that it gets its way into all these areas, and thus we can come in behind them, piggybacking on it. There's certainly no means to do it purely on the basis of interest in political attitudes. So I can't think of one right now, but I doubt that polling was done in those situations. But these kind of global shifts tend to happen in a broad-based way. It's not. I don't think you should assume that it's going to happen, if it does happen, in a kind of top-down way. There are important, but it's at the same time important to remember that there are major resistances. It's not that the Taliban is really attractive. It's not that they had a positive experience. It's not that there's an unknown. It's not that they're holding out something that's really compelling. And just the fact that people say that they don't express a lot, that they don't feel, have a lot of fear about the Taliban returning is I think important. And it's not really easy to see how the scenario would unfold. It's more likely that with all that there would be an erosion of confidence, and then you have a kind of unknown. You have a very fluid situation, and then it becomes somewhat unpredictable what the outcome would be. And yes, that can happen very quickly in these kinds of situations, particularly when you have people who don't have real loyalties, who don't have long-term connections to these larger. You have local political forces that may engender loyalty, but at the national level, it could be very fluid.
It's an interesting question. In part, what you're raising is, when do elites know more than the public do? And when I say elites, I mean people who are really studying the issue versus the people who are just out there living their lives within the issue. And I wish I had a simple answer. If you read James Siriecki's book, Wisdom of Crowds, I think he would say that the people tend to know an awful lot. At the same time, when you have processes that aren't necessarily mass processes, in general public processes, but where the dynamics are on the side of small energized groups, perhaps as we saw in Iraq, that it's hard to say that the public will be anticipating what's going to be occurring. And so I guess if somehow we had taken the elites, the political elites in the United States, and isolated them from all polling, and would they have predicted the outcome of the November elections? I don't know. But if by asking a lot of people, could you get a pretty good bead on what was happening? And the answer was yes. So it's an interesting problem. I wouldn't necessarily say that in a conflict region that the public will be the first to know, but I would always want to feed in what the public's views of agents like the Taliban are to get an understanding of what sort of progress they seem to be making.
I would add to that, too. Remember that there's the social structures that could be revolutionized rely on acquiescence of all kinds of people at all kinds of level, particularly soldiers. And then often the critical point in a revolutionary situation is when the soldiers stop taking orders from their commanders, and that is, you know, at a fairly low level.
Yes, sir.
Your survey is a lot rosier than ABC, BBC. And there's, I think, a month of difference in surveys.
I think I'd see the patterns fairly similar. If, for example, I showed one question that was really, they showed a 20-point drop in right direction, wrong direction, and that was almost identical to the drop we did. They asked the question a little bit differently. And so I don't know if I see dramatic differences between.
The reason I asked is that summer was really hot for all the bombings. And right now it's almost getting back
quiet
to normal. Could it be the reason that people are forgetting the terrible summer that they had? And also the other point I want to ask you. Today, number one question in all our listeners' mind is corruption. I mean, that is number one. It used to be economy before that was security, but now it's corruption. You didn't really dig into that.
We just had a single question on corruption, and it proved to be related to some of the other important variables in the study. I think it would be important and interesting if we survey again regularly in the future to capture that measure. Perceptions of things like crime and corruption are issues that the public has a difficulty with and elites have a difficulty with. Crime statistics often aren't very good at tracking increases and decreases in crime, and the public's feelings about it aren't very good either. But if you ask the right question to representative samples, have you experienced your car stolen, and do this over a period of time, you find that you get good measures of the rates of car theft. So I would find it very interesting to be able to capture this rather tight measure. Have you experienced government, you or your family, government corruption in the last year, to really get a sharper measure of this thing that we talk widely about, we think is this very serious problem, and it probably is, but it would be interesting to be able to quantify it in terms of its incidence.
I have Marvin and then two people over here.
Marvin Lindbaum, Middle East Institute. When you have a battery of questions, obviously, some are, well, let me put it this way. When in the battery of questions, you find one or two that seem to be so counterintuitive, so counter-evidential, one does have to say, wait a second now, if that's the case, if that's the finding, can I really feel that there's credibility in some of the others? You know, if they've gotten that, assuming it is wrong, they've gotten that so wrong. How much? Now, the one I'm thinking of, obviously, there is one, and that's the one on the two. There are actually two questions that have to do with the central government and local government. Everything that we seem to know suggests that people relate to the local government. The central government, the one thing they haven't done is they haven't really figured importantly in the lives of the average person. And that's a great cause of great disappointment and to deliver and so on. And yet from your findings, that isn't reflected at all in those two questions. In fact, it's just the reverse. Now, it may very well be that that kind of question required a conceptualization which was much more difficult for people to make. Whereas, are you safe or are you less safe? You like cars, I don't like cars. That may be easier for individuals to work with. And maybe it's the question itself, but I just wanted to put on the table here that that was, that finding for me is a little disturbing.
I don't have a solution to your,
I
don't have a solution to your conundrum. And I would say that maybe the question we asked and how we tend to read it might be not just the same way that a respondent reads it. That's always possible. And in some ways, I envy Seema and that and her interviewers who can, whenever they come to an issue like that, and say, "Why are you telling me that? Give me, you know, tell me more. And what do you mean by this?" And I think that's that testifies to the richness of the more flexible interviewing structure. And in some respects, I see our, let us say, more standard polling techniques at once being a blunt instrument and at once being a sharp instrument. And in some ways, we can't explore that surprising issue. At the same time, we are able to gauge differences, changes in ways that more flexible forms of data gathering aren't so well able to do. And so I don't have an answer in terms of exactly why people would feel that the most powerful authority in their area was the central government rather than, as we characterize, the local leaders.
Seema?
I just wanted to comment a little bit about it because I was lucky in the fact that I was able to ask those follow-up questions, the whys, and get at sort of the nuances of how different Afghans hear different questions. And held a number of focus groups, which is probably what I should have mentioned. Those, some of those questions I outlined up top, what does security mean, how do women view it, is what I held my focus groups to try and find out. And, you know, I think that that's part of the word choice and the word choicing that we're able to use. I mean, the pollsters, when they get the chance to ask follow-up questions, if yes, then why, and give a number of offers of to what can be the whys, get some of that flexibility. But in the question that you brought out, Marvin, is the local government and the central government, which is more effective, in my mind stands out because most people don't have day-to-day experience with central government officials. And so, you know, this can do one of two things. In some sense, it can make them seem better, because if they're getting bad experiences by the local government, you know, by local government official or by local people, then they might think those guys in Kabul are way better than what I've got going on here in my vicinity. Or it could be just the opposite, that, you know, the fact that they're not experiencing them is what's creating a tendency to move towards local governments.
More effective. There's a couple different questions here involved here, and we had a pair that in your area, what is the most powerful authority, and what is the most respected authority? We had two questions like that. Our objective there was primarily to try to get a handle and find out about the Taliban, frankly, to see if the Taliban were thought to be have strength in their area or to be in high regard in their area. And so we probably put more energy looking at that data element than trying to explore the contrast between local government and central government.
One thing that's important to keep in mind is that Afghanistan is a country that's never had a strong central government.
There's also a people, again, don't answer questions always the way you want them to do. And so sometimes you get if they see a question that has a plus or a minus, they may see, the real question in my mind is who has more status in the central government? Well, because it's bigger and more powerful, that makes it more, you know, stronger and more effective by the fact that it's, you know, it's at the top of the heap, right? And so we may just be learning from this that the central government has that kind of status. And remember, too, that there may be some desire to express some positive feeling relative to the Taliban as a baseline.
Gentlemen, way over here.
I hope my voice works for this session. I'm Dennis Scotch. I'm a consultant working with the U.S. Institute of Peace. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Working with the U.S. Institute of Peace on a project to measure progress in conflict environments. And my questions are generic or have to do with the process. One is, how do you fuse anybody? How do you fuse the quantitative data that comes out of the polls with the more nuanced qualitative data that comes from interviewing and other sources? And this, of course, relates to the tipping point question that Rick Bartner was asking, because it also deals with idiosyncratic factors that don't have trend lines to them. The other question has to do with fusing or interpreting differences, interpreting words and information, words and situations across cultural differences. So I'll just throw those open.
The question had to do with how one fuses information derived from different sources, polling, interviews, etc. And I'm going to ask Seema to address that. And the other question was what techniques one uses for bridging gaps in the culturally driven interpretation of questions and words and so on.
I feel like I should hand this off since Rick is sitting here, and he is kind of the brainstorm behind our methodology that, you know, I think it starts to do these things. That was our original goal, is how do we do it, basically answer those two questions. In the way we've done it in the Measure of Progress study here at CSIS is that we have kind of not denied anybody a chance to weigh in. And so we've brought in information, both quantitative and qualitative data information, into our study, essentially. I mean, this gets into a little bit more detail than I think we want to go into here. But we look through media, through public documentation, through our qualitative interviews, polling questions that have both qualitative and quantitative aspect, asking two questions. Does this affect the ordinary Afghan? Is these three sentences showing something about change on the ground that ordinary Afghans are experiencing? Is it coming from their perspective? And two, is it outcome based? Are we talking about not number of kids, you know, not dollars spent, or not plans for what will happen in the future when monies are approved, but what has happened? So we really look at what's, you know, wait for it to pass and then see the effect of it to try and get at, you know, impact as opposed to inputs and outcomes. And then we take all this mixed information, and this is how we do both, you know, jump into offering a quantitative study and bridge the cultural divide. We do is gather a team of raters. And our analysis team, we pulled from the wisdom of the crowds, actually, which is that people probably know more than a couple experts. And we tried to grab, a wide and diverse group of people to read all of our information and rate it on the scales of, this year we were really lucky to have Afghans and internationals, a wide mix of development people, ordinary people weigh in. But what we ask them to do is read this information and quantify to what extent Afghan needs or interests are being met in this, you know, in this piece of information, and to what extent legitimate capacity building is happening in the state and society to meet those needs in the future. Now, I know I just used a lot of powerfully charged words, legitimate and, you know, and those kind of things, but we try to figure out ways to determine what legitimacy is using some of what I found in my focus groups about what legitimacy means to Afghans, and bringing that back here to our raters and our training. It's the one method that we pick, and I think that it tends to work quite well, because what it does is take 7,000, 6,000 qualitative and quantitative pieces, allow Afghans and internationals to weigh in on it, and then present it in a way that's very quick impact on a graph that decision makers and policy makers that are probably not going to spend the time to read all 100 pages of our report can still get a sense of trends and where things are moving in all sectors and across a variety of provinces. So,
sir.
Najmal Ghani from Latin American Chamber of Commerce. First of all, congratulations on finding the report. Somebody who's been to Afghanistan since December of 2001, and I keep going back and forth, again, as an Afghan and as an American. I want to congratulate you. I have a question and two comments, and one is to Mr. Toll. The first comment is, you partner on the ground, the Afghan Center for Social Opinion. Who is it headed by, and how confident are you that they did the right job? That number one. I'm going to go through the comments. The comments, I think it's very clear and obvious that the Afghans feel that the construction process has been done on the cheap. Simple as that. 20-1 compared to Iraq. And I don't think they're very happy about it. You've been in Afghanistan and you know that those are on the ground and are here. And of course, the international community's commitment has not been up to par. But more importantly, the American commitment has not been. And I think the reason why the polls are changing, the attitude of the people are changing because of the expectations that they have of the U.S. The other one is the confidence on the Afghan government. Lately, the Afghan government and its inability to produce or to give to the people what they needed will bring the, what you have mentioned, confidence. If you don't have confidence, then loyalty comes. I think it's premature for you to say that the loyalty of the Afghan or the people are not known. The loyalty to themselves, after 25 years of war, what kind of loyalty will you have? We've seen loyalty from my representative in Congress before the war in Iraq and last week. So everything is relative, in a sense. But again, the confidence on the Afghan government.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about your partners.
We could start with your first question. Axor is a fairly well-established polling company headquartered in Kabul. We work with their American partners who spend a lot of time. Our contact is in Kabul. And presently, I suspect they do more polling in Afghanistan than anybody else. But I don't have hard data on that. But they were the firm that the Asia Foundation selected, that BBC uses, that we've used a couple of times. And we've looked at their methodology fairly carefully. They seem to be well developed. I know they do some, quite a bit of work for federal agencies as well. So I think polling in Afghanistan, polling in the U.S. is not an easy thing, but I think as a sound organization with a good plan and a good, rather good track record, I guess we're fairly confident that they're doing what they say they're doing.
So, did you want to address the question of confidence in the government?
Confidence in the government and Afghan expectations. Yeah, I think that you're right. You hear it in the circles of people on the ground about the reconstruction effort being done on the cheap, and you know the people's budgets feel squeezed. But there's a lot. You know, it's given the resource that we have. I think that the sad thing is we could have gone further with them. You know, we continue here in America to be able to press our Congress and try and push them to let go more money and pressure OMB to realize that more money is needed. But once that money is on the ground, you know, I think that there are better ways that it can be used. And essentially, you know, one of the recommendations that we're playing with and that we want to, you know, bring out is how to get the money on the ground faster so that it empowers people as opposed to, you know, keeping it sort of locked up in Kabul. And I think that that plays into the confidence of the government. By throwing all the money into that center area and then letting it trickle down has been slow. And, you know, the expectations are that the government is supposed is getting all the money and therefore should be doing almost everything. But I found Afghans to be extremely resourceful. You know, they know how to, they've spent years doing, you know, things on their own, self-governing, self-adjudicating, you know, meeting their basic needs and supporting each other in local communities. And so, you know, I guess what I would like to see is that if there is, the national government is only able to spend 44% of its development money. How come it's not being shifted into the, you know, local communities which can do something with it today? And so, you know, I think that's part of the confidence in the government will take time. They'll need to see that the government's able to do things to have confidence in them. And in the meantime, their needs are going unmet. And other people are filling that vacuum, people that we don't find as desirable. So, you know, I think that as we build, we have to have a little bit more patience here, but do things today, and that's to get the money a little bit more decentralized, get it into the hands of local people, use programs like the NSP, the National Solidarity Program, which allows local communities to design and develop their own development programming, and use those innovations to try and build confidence in the government over time.
But if you do the same poll next year, and if this trend goes on, you'll see these changes in these numbers. Negative numbers will go up, because this new resurgence of the Taliban is a reaction from the people because of these problems, because it's not being addressed, because there's not enough, and there's not governance.
Right. That's one thing that I found, which was, you know, in the South and the East, and this is the last sort of response comment that I'll make, but I tried to get a sense of what are the Taliban providing and what are we providing. If you're an ordinary person in the South and you've got a farm and you weigh up which way your loyalties are going to align, you're going to see who's providing me with the most of what I need the most. And so, for Afghans in the South and East, where the Taliban is gaining ground, the Taliban are offering, protection against eradication forces. I'm not making blanket statements about the whole South, but in some areas, they're offering protection against eradication forces, aka economic security and economic livelihoods protection. And they're adjudicating a number of pretty high-level criminal cases of local commanders that are known to be conducted crimes. So they're providing some sort of very harsh, but some sort of justice in a place that the government has not been able to build up courts. And what is the international community providing? We're providing health opportunities, education opportunities, some sort of infrastructure. And I think that the question is, how do these weigh up against each other? I mean, the Taliban is targeting the education facilities, and if that hurts the Afghans more than the local commander, sort of being able to run around willy-nilly, then maybe we're doing the right thing. My sense is that we're probably not getting our priorities right on the ground in the South, and by focusing on eradication or more central governors coming in that might not know the people or that might not have the same rapport with the people, that we're missing out on doing things that they need, which is money to pay their families and have, a job so that they're not idle youth and ex-commanders hanging around. So I think that needs to be realigned.
Just
as an observation, I think the
overall thrust of our findings suggest that the government and NATO forces continue to have some goodwill, that the Taliban appears to have a lot of ill will. However, that continuing these trends is not the way to make a success of Afghanistan. And so that in a number of ways, I think that these data from the average Afghan in the street is more than half full, but it's spilling out. And so I think that's how I would read these trends.
I certainly didn't mean to imply that there was anything superficial about the nature of Afghan society, but very much as you said, they're extraordinary survivors, and in those situations they are very flexible and fluid, and that might be just exactly what they need. But it is important for us to, when they align themselves, to realize that this doesn't mean that we should just assume that they're in the hand of the camp of the West forever or something like that.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me thank all our panelists. And let me thank you for being with you. I would urge you to take a look at the detailed report that Steve Weber has put together today. I would also urge you to take a look at the Measuring Progress in Afghanistan report that came out of our post-conflict resolution program. I think they will give you a much greater texture if you look at the details, even than the fine presentations we've heard.
And while we're doing commercials, if you would like to be on our e-alert list to get announcements of new studies and polls coming out of pipenworldpublicopinion.org, give us your card and we'll put you on the list.